Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kim Ives, editor of the newspaper Haiti Progrès, who assesses Haiti's recent national election and the challenges ahead for returning President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Dorothy Granada, founder of the Women's Clinic in rural Mulucucu, Nicaragua, who talks about recent government attacks against non-governmental organizations in the wake of the Sandinista Party's gains in municipal elections there. And Anne Nelson, former director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, who discusses the responsibilities of reporters in wartime. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Four years ago, the Taliban movement stormed out of northwest Pakistan and quickly took over Kabul, the capital city of Afghanistan. The Taliban imposed harsh Islamic rule that effectively banished women from participating in many sectors of society. Girls were expelled from schools, women were prohibited from leaving their homes without a male relative, and many women were denied medical treatment by male doctors in hospitals. The treatment of women by the Taliban was so extreme that Amnesty International declared that the entire female population of Afghanistan were prisoners of conscience. Still, over the last several years, most Western media outlets lost interest in the abuses inflicted by the Taliban, argues Extra, the magazine published by the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. The mainstream media has gone to other global hotspots like Kosovo, even though the issues in the Afghan story include gross human rights abuses, drug trafficking, religious extremism, and oil money. Too often, Western reporters peg the Taliban with code words like traditional or fundamentalist, implying that the regime is the natural outgrowth of a violent Afghan culture. Reporters ignored the recent history of the CIA, which pumped in over $4 billion in weapons and military training to religious extremist anti-communist groups. In the U.S., feminist leaders such as Eleanor Schmiel want the American government to impose sanctions against the Taliban's top backers, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Further, any future international discussions with the Taliban should include human rights groups, exiled Afghans, and women's groups, say feminists. It would be an important first step to bring peace and stability to this war-ravaged area of the globe. Since 1998, there has been a U.S. State Department-issued travel advisory warning American tourists not to visit Yemen. The rationale was clear. 16 foreign tourists had been kidnapped, and four were later killed by a terrorist group. But the powerful American military never got the message. Recently retired Marine General Anthony Zanini, who was the commander of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, made the decision to make Yemen a refueling stop as a friendly gesture to improve diplomatic relations in the region. On October 12th, two suicide bombers in a speedboat rammed the USS Cole. The blast killed 17 American sailors. According to the Washington Monthly magazine, the USS Cole debacle was just another example of the Pentagon brass having too much influence over U.S. foreign policy. Critics say the growing clout of the military and top decision-making has put the outgoing Clinton administration on the wrong side of many international issues. Right now, the U.S. is opposing a treaty creating the International Criminal Court to prosecute war crimes. The opposition is based on the questionable fear among Pentagon generals that American soldiers might be charged with genocide or other human rights abuses. More embarrassingly, the U.S. and Somalia were the only two countries to vote against a United Nations ban on recruiting soldiers under 18 years of age. With the incoming Bush administration, the Joint Chiefs of Staff are looking for a $30 billion spending boost in the military budget over the rest of the decade. Meanwhile, the State Department is hobbled with a tiny $2 million budget, leaving over 300 vacant positions in overseas embassies. And many military staffers now fill important diplomatic posts, a situation that, according to many observers, won't be likely to lead to the peaceful resolution of conflicts around the world in the future. As if high school weren't tough enough, a few isolated incidents of violence have produced an atmosphere of intimidation for any student who deviates from the norm. The latest assault on the civil liberties of the young comes in the form of a corporate-sponsored program called WAVE, which stands for Working Against Violence Everywhere. The program is sponsored by Pinkerton's, Inc., which built its reputation on union busting. WAVE provides brochures to students listing traits which Pinkerton says indicates a potentially dangerous student. These include social withdrawal, being easily angered by small things, and feelings of excessive rejection. Each student gets a colorful wallet card that provides discounts at local merchants and lists an 800 number they can use to anonymously turn in classmates. Programs like WAVE are especially dangerous because they open the door to wider use of profiling individuals to detect and prosecute nonconformists. Despite the dramatic media coverage of the shooting at the Columbine High School, the overwhelming number of schools never see a shooting. In fact, last October, Janet Reno presented a report documenting a drop in school violence of 30% over the last 8 years. This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Frazier and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
So much recent attention on the 5-week dispute over the US presidential election, in this week's program, we'll be focusing on elections elsewhere. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected president of Haiti in 1990 after decades of brutal dictatorship under the Duvalier family. But a military coup cut short Aristide's presidency in 1991 after just 7 months in office. The former Catholic priest fled into exile, but was returned to power after a combined UN-US military force ousted the coup makers in 1994. His term cut short, Aristide left office in 1995 and was succeeded by his ally, René Préval. Eligible to run again for the presidency this year, Aristide ran and won an overwhelming victory in the November 26th election. But opposition parties boycotted the vote, and governments, including the US, refused to send observers because of criticisms of legislative and local elections held last May. Although opposition figures and some press reports estimated turnout for the vote as low as 10%, Aristide and his Lavalas family party are generally acknowledged to enjoy broad grassroots support from Haiti's impoverished population. Despite threats from Washington, Aristide has declared his intention to work hard to improve the life of Haiti's poor and resist the neoliberal economic policies advocated by the US, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Kim Ives, editor of the newspaper Haiti Progrès, who assesses Haiti's recent national election and the challenges ahead for returning President Aristide.
Haiti had for 30 years, an organization called the Tontamakut, many people have heard of this, which was essentially a paramilitary death squad organization set up by the Duvalier dictatorship, that is the dictatorships of Papa Doc and Baby Doc, Jean-Claude and François Duvalier, from 1957 through 1986. And this paramilitary organization was disbanded nominally in 1986, but really it continued to exist instead of overtly, covertly. And it has been used since that period for the past 14 years to really sow terror against Haiti's ongoing democratic movement. In recent years, these forces of darkness, as they're called in Haiti, and generally, instead of being able to officially go around and extort money from peasants and from storekeepers and from businessmen, they now have to do it in a more illegal way, going around robbing banks, murdering people, holding people up, carjacking, etc. A lot of these people are believed to be also in the hire of the CIA, and we believe that there is a campaign of destabilization against the government, not only President René Préval right now, but that this campaign of destabilization will continue against the incoming administration of Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Jean-Bertrand Aristide will be taking office in February. First of all, what is his agenda? And then we can certainly discuss the U.S. role in as you said, destabilizing his incoming regime.
The centerpiece is really to create 500,000 new jobs in the country. He's looking to revitalize all the public domains of health, education, and he's looking to put a school in every single rural commune, as they're called in Haiti, which is like a county. There's 565 of those. Most of the schools in Haiti right now are in very bad shape, have no chairs often, no blackboard. Usually the teachers are little more than students themselves, often practically illiterate. And why is this? It's because Haiti is forced to fork over about $5 million in interest payments, $4.8 million a month on debt that it owes for loans that Jean-Claude Duvalier took out in the 1980s, most of which ended up in Swiss bank accounts. But the Haitian people are still being asked to pay back that debt. And this is one of the things that a number of popular organizations and groups in Haiti have been protesting for years, that this debt is not the Haitian people's. It's Jean-Claude Duvalier's. They should go get it from him. Last year, Aristide published a book, which essentially was a kind of a anti-neoliberal treatise, which said that we have to find alternatives to the neoliberal order being handed down to us. We're looking for Aristide in his own way to try to push forward Haiti's nationalist and democratic program, which was really what he was elected for in 1990 and now again in the year 2000.
Given President Aristide's opposition to neoliberal policy, which is the holy grail of Democratic or Republican administrations, and we've certainly seen hostility to Aristide both by Clinton and his predecessor, George Bush Sr., what is in store for Aristide with the new Bush administration?
Well, like you say, Scott, I think it's going to be a very stormy time with George W. Bush coming in. I mean, a lot of people say that George W. will just be an extension of his father, and first time tragedy, second time farce is one saying that comes to mind. But it's for sure that the Republicans are extremely hostile. Recently, Representatives Gilman and Goss and Senator Jesse Helms issued a statement on the Haitian elections, which essentially have said that the elections were completely illegitimate with the, and I quote, the sole purpose of delivering absolute power over Haiti's government to Mr. Jean-Bertrand Aristide. In their statement, they say that the president should make sure that Aristide is barred from coming to the Summit of the Americas in April 2001, that the country is run by narco-traffickers, criminals, and other anti-democratic elements, and that they should, quote, feel the full weight of U.S. law enforcement. Their U.S. visas must be denied or stripped from them, their green card status reviewed to ensure compliance with the requirements of this status, and their ill-gotten assets frozen. So we'll see what happens, but most Haitians are expecting a pretty tough period.
That was Kim Ives, editor of the newspaper Haiti Progrès. Contact Haiti Progrès by calling area code 718-434-8100 or visit its website at www.haitiprogres.com. Recent municipal elections in Nicaragua resulted in a number of Sandinista Party victories, including mayoral seats in Managua and Matagalpa. Nicaragua's conservative president Arnaldo Alemán initially refused to honor the results, but after citizens took to the streets in protest, he reluctantly accepted his party's losses. Since then, however, Alemán's government has launched a series of attacks against a number of non-governmental organizations and solidarity groups viewed as allies of the Sandinistas. So far, more than 20 projects have been closed down, including Ayuda Obrera Suiza, a Swiss organization that supports the women's clinic in Mulukuku, a poor rural area in northeastern Nicaragua. On November the 14th, President Alemán visited Mulukuku and publicly threatened the clinic with an investigation and criminal charges against its members, based on allegations that the clinic served only Sandinistas. Between the lines, Denise Manzari spoke with Dorothy Granada, a nurse and U.S. citizen who founded the clinic. She spoke about the political tension which now threatens her work on behalf of Nicaragua's poor.
We're in the North Atlantic Autonomous Region, And actually, our program is part of a women's cooperative of about 50 members. And we have a health clinic for women, as well as other women's services, like services against violence, literacy, and so on, to serve the campesina women of this area.
How long has the clinic been in existence?
About almost 11 years.
Has it run fairly without incident in these 11 years?
We've had no problems. You know, it's an area which was heavily hit by the war. It was one of the most intense war zones. And there are a lot of former, well, they're called now resistant, former Contra, resettled in the area, and lots of violence. There's always been lots of violence. But directly to the clinic, no.
Can you also put into perspective for our listeners the people of Mulukuku?
Yeah, it's rural. It's an area which is populated by campesinos, farmers, many of them landless, many of them working on big farms or trying to borrow a little space so they can, they're subsistence farmers. Every family, whether it was on the side of the Contras or the side of the Sandinistas, lost people in the war. People have been displaced, some of them many times. There's a lot of post-traumatic stress syndrome, a lot of intrafamilial violence. So it's a difficult place to work, and it's a place that's very hard on women. So we have tried to concentrate our work on women.
Nicaragua recently had their elections where
yes.
A number of Sandinistas have won by popular vote.
That's right.
Now, as this relates to the cooperative and the clinic and Mulukuku, you
yes.
feel that there is a threat directly to the clinic. Do you want to tell the listeners why you feel that?
There was misinformation given to the president when he came to our community to dedicate some houses built by a loan from Taiwan. And the president was told that there was a clinic in town run by a non-governmental organization or an NGO that was only serving Sandinistas. So he, the president, said, well, we're going to investigate them immediately and put them in jail if it's indicated.
Do you know who
yes.
supplied this
yes.
misinformation? Can you talk about
do
that?
Do I know who did it? Yes. It's a member of the party who was just elected to vice mayor for Paiwas on the other side of the river. So on the basis of that, we had an investigation, two delegations from Managua. First thing was they found out we're not a non-governmental organization, we're a cooperative. We do, however, receive support, not the clinic directly, but some of our programs, like our program, A Legal Defense of Women. We do receive help from a Swiss non-governmental organization. We did mention that because he said, well, what organizations are, I mean, the investigators asked what international organization we're related to. And we mentioned that Ayuda Obrera Suiza, so the next day they closed it down. Now, Ayuda Obrera Suiza is an international mission which has a convenio, an arrangement, between the Swiss government and the Nicaraguan government. So that closure stopped 25 projects in the countryside serving thousands upon thousands of people. But that didn't seem to make any difference to the investigator, so probably will be for some time.
How many patients in a given week does your cooperative clinic serve?
Our clinic, well, we serve an average of 1,000 a month.
Has Aliman curtailed what you're able to do for the people at this point?
No, the government hasn't, but we have slowed down. We are now treating only emergencies, doing treatment to pre-cancer patients.
So essentially you've been accused of serving only Sandinistas by this person who supplied the misinformation.
Yes, and of course it's ridiculous. We have 23,500 patient records, and there are only less than 6,000 Sandinistas in the entire municipality. They're former Contra combatants and their families there.
You serve whoever needs your help, be they Sandinistas.
We serve according to our criteria, and we give preference to pregnant women, women who are doing family planning, and we give preference to cancer screening.
Regardless of political or religious affiliation?
Absolutely none. And that has been the policy from the very beginning.
That was Dorothy Granada, director of the Women's Clinic in Mulukuku, Nicaragua. For more information, call the Women's Empowerment Network, area code 831-768-7004. December the 2nd marked the 20th anniversary of the murders of four American churchwomen in El Salvador. A commemoration event held at the Maryknoll Missionaries headquarters in Ossining, New York, on that date, featured a panel discussion on the faith that inspired the women and the continuing search for justice in their cases and in those of 70,000 Salvadorans who died in the war that spanned the 1980s. Ann Nelson, a panelist at the event, worked as a freelance journalist in Central America during that period. She covered the wars in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala for various media outlets. She later became executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, an organization dedicated to safeguarding those courageous reporters who risk their lives in pursuing the truth. Before the Maryknoll panel discussion, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nelson about her experiences as a war correspondent and the role and responsibilities of reporters in wartime.
There was a younger core of journalists who became more and more independent, covered the war by crossing the lines between the army and the guerrillas. And in fact, it was easier for us as American journalists to cross those lines and be independent than it probably had been for any journalists in any other setting. It created a very different perspective. At the same time, the human rights movement was starting to have its earliest shape in the United States. And those ideas started to influence journalist thinking. So I would say that now, when journalists go into a conflict, they're much more likely to look at civilian casualties, to look at human rights abuses, and to say, are the laws of war being followed? How are armies respecting Geneva Conventions, and so on? And that thinking has gotten more and more prominence. You also have to say that that's been possible because of the end of the Cold War, and a lot of the ideological constraints are not as strong as they were in earlier days.
When journalists are covering the war, I guess based a lot on what medium they represent, do you feel that there's just, it's hard to get out perspectives of the people who maybe aren't represented among the elite or among, you know, whoever's controlling the country? Did you have that experience when you were covering the wars in Central America, getting in touch with those people and getting their voices out to your audience?
A lot of that question depends on who's publishing the story. And there are some publications that really want that from the reporters. For example, I'm a big fan of the foreign reporting of the Christian Science Monitor. I feel that they look at many, many sectors and societies very carefully in their international reporting, and are also open to some of the young, hungry journalists who will throw themselves out in the countryside for 2 weeks and say, what's going on with peasants? Now, a lot of the reporters from major newspapers have to be in the capital to report every time the ambassador or the head of state gives a speech and does this routine coverage, which is also very important. But they're often tied to those foreign policy-oriented stories and miss some of the bigger social evolutions in the places they're covering.
When you worked as executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, did you see any trends over time in how journalists were able to do their work or how they were prevented from doing their work, ultimately even to be killed?
One thing that we would find at the Committee to Protect Journalists was that the hot spots would change, and the hot spots would be places where there were large numbers of journalists killed for political reasons. In general, if you have an authoritarian society where certain restraints are lifted, there can be these bursts of violence, and journalists are often in the front lines of those, because if they report abuses, they become very inconvenient to the people who've committed abuses, and then they're often targeted by them. So Central America had a large number of journalists who were killed in the course of the conflict, some of them people I knew and worked with. The Philippines had a large number. The former Yugoslavia had a very large number. And you know, everybody would use the cliche, kill the messenger. You know, if you kill the witness and the person who is publicizing the abuses, maybe you will be free to commit future abuses in silence. And I think that groups that are press freedom groups are an essential part of the chain of human rights responsibility. It's very important that they maintain themselves of being independent of any political party of any government, and to be able to say, what is the international human rights law that applies to this situation? Who looks out for the civilians and the peasants and the people who are caught up in these struggles and are usually the biggest victims?
Do you have any comment on how the internet has changed people's access to information, especially in situations of war, like, you know, with Yugoslavia or the former countries that made up Yugoslavia? There was a lot of word that got out through the internet, and, you know, a lot of us now get emails from everywhere with information that previously was not available. Do you think that that's fundamentally changing information exchange among people, or at least people who have computer access, or do you think that that isn't all that important?
I think the internet has been a mixed blessing. I am certainly glad it's there. But I feel that what's happened is that the band of people in a society who have access to the internet, in the US it may be 50%, in less developed countries it may be 10%, have an access to an unprecedented amount of information. What we've lost is a sense of priority for information and how to decide what's important, how to build a combination of sources and bodies of information that we know how to use. At the same time, we're being bombarded with entertainment media and trivialities on the internet and elsewhere that create a kind of white noise in our lives. And I certainly suffer from information overload, where I'll spend 2 hours on the internet and I'll come out of it and say, well, what did I learn that matters? And I think that we're all going to have to go through a period of self orientation to figure out how to use this media in our real lives.
That was Ann Nelson, former head of the Committee to Protect Journalists, who currently serves as the director of the International Program at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. Contact the Committee to Protect Journalists at area code 212-465-1004 or visit its website at www.cpj.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Fraser, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elena Sowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.